Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sam. We are back on Open World, and let me tell you, when I say that it has been a rough couple weeks, not even going to get into it, don't even feel like getting into it, just know that I'm back. Going to take a little bit of a shorter show tonight, and then back next week we will be back to mean schedule, because I think that's about time to start getting back to normal life. All that kind of fun stuff. So as we always do, we are going to go over some Am I the Asshole? Because I love these threads. They're wild and they're fun. Here we go. Ooh, whoa, okay. Can I even see this on radio? We're going to see. Okay. Am I the asshole for calling my sister a coke whore? I think your imagination can figure out what that word actually is. So a whore. I, 18 female, live with my parents and my sister Joanne, 23 female. Joanne has a cocaine habit and she claims it's normal in her job and just a lifestyle of chefing, yada yada. That's not normal, but okay. We're getting off to a wild start. This whole radio show just started off really wild today. Okay, we went there. My parents seem to be ignoring it since Joanne pays her rent on time and keeps to herself when she's in the house and doesn't cause many problems. I'm a college student on a government grant, and I'm in college Monday to Friday up till about 5 or 6 p.m. Working isn't really an option for me right now, so I don't get out much, and I spend all my money on college supplies. I worked when I was in university. What do you mean college work isn't an option? What the f***? This chick just screams entitled already, but okay, here we go. Joanne doesn't seem to understand this and is always asking to borrow money and whatnot. I always say no because it works out that I only have 40 euros every week to spend on drug addicts too. They ask for more money, and if they don't get what they want, they steal from you. Anyway, I got a Christmas bonus on my grant, and I ended up deciding to book tickets for a small-ish local gig that's next week. I booked two, one for me and one for my best friend because her birthday is the same day and she loves that type of music. It was meant to be a surprise for her. I told Joanne about this on one of her good days because I was genuinely excited to finally do something and live the college lifestyle for a night. The tickets were digital on an account shared with my parents. Joanne had asked for the login, telling them she wanted to book tickets to something, but she was lying and used it to sell my tickets for drug money. Well, duh. Anyway, I didn't find out until I had gotten the email to confirm that the tickets were sent to someone else, and I was really confused at first. I checked out, and they were sent to someone I know Joanne knows. I went straight to her when she got home and asked what she did, and she tried lying, but I showed her the proof. It went to someone she knows, and I told her I wanted my money back and was then and there. She told me it was gone already. I lost my mind and started yelling at her because it wasn't fair. My mom was just in from work, and I was screaming at my sister, who was crying at that point, saying she was sorry, and she didn't know it would upset me this much. Well, of course it did. She's a drug addict. Hello? My mom got involved and told me to keep my voice down, and we'll talk about it, and I told her to shut up and stay out of it. I ended up saying something along the lines of, why is it fair that you get to do this to me when I've never even drank alcohol or smoked weed? Why does the coke-whore get to be the golden child, but not me? My mom stepped in and put a stop to it right then and there. My sister had started screaming back at me for what I called her. My mom said that I was out of line and she just made a mistake. I told my mom her mistake cost me the only night out I'll ever be able to have all year, so she should hear what I have to say about it. My mom thinks I was in the wrong for what I said. My sister won't even look at me, even though it's been 3 days and I've tried apologizing. Am I the asshole? What? What? What the hell is going on? Okay, so we're going straight to the Reddit comment. Report the tickets as stolen. Tell the person that bought them that they bought stolen property. Next time you know your sister has drugs on her, call the police. Edit to add, I get out of work, turn on my phone, and I am completely buried in upvotes with a couple of words thrown in. Thank you all very much. Well, yeah, this is some straight common sense, man. People are agreeing she should report this incident to the police. Exactly. This incident should be reported. OP should not be apologizing for anything. She was the one who got robbed. It's inappropriate for you to apologize or lying to your parents she has an addiction. Yeah. I mean, how? Yeah. Following comments, not the asshole. Do not apologize. Never trust her again. People are asking if she's, why is she still living with her? I mean, honestly, like, I mean, I'd be in the same boat. Not the asshole. Joanne doesn't have a cocaine habit. She's an addict. She's a full-blown addict if she's stealing from you. You need to sit down with your parents to know you do not want any personal information shared with her. She needs to either pay these tickets back and get help, or you will be filing a police report. Then you lock and protect your stuff, maybe even a camera. Edit. Numerous people have brought up a great point. Change all your personal information. Don't give the information to your parents. Let them know it has been changed. You will no longer be sharing an account with anyone. It's not up for conversation. It is a statement. I don't understand why that wasn't a thing in the first place. If you're old enough to go to college, you're old enough to have your own account for your own ticket. And if it's your own money, like, I don't know, this whole thing is just blowing my mind. I can't even. I white girl can't even. Definitely not the asshole. That's what I'm going to say. Next one. This sounds interesting. Am I the asshole for not helping my wife with the kids when she wanted to keep them home from daycare and I have to work? So my wife and I have two kids, and one who is a bit over two and another that is 5 months old. I work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 from home. Occasionally I go in the office. My wife is on maternity leave and taking care of the 5-month-old. I take care of the baby for overnight wakings and feeding. The 2-year-old is in daycare. Whether I send my kid to daycare 1 or 5 days a week for 1 hour or 8, it costs the same. My wife likes to pick up our toddler from daycare on 3:15 every day instead of letting me go when I finish work because she doesn't want our kid to be there so much during the day. The problem is I'm left watching the baby for 45 minutes while she is gone, and then for the hour that she is taking care of both of them before, when she gets overwhelmed, stressed, or very annoyed at me, our kids, it's just not great overall. Every day my wife tells me that she is exhausted, she has no self, she doesn't get things done that she needs to, she's overwhelmed, she wants to relax when the baby naps, etc. I try to help with the baby during the day when I can, like feeding and putting him down during my lunch break. I just try to be available throughout the day if my wife needs me. Anyways, on the main point of this post, last night my wife tells me that she wants to keep the toddler home from daycare today. I told her I didn't think it was a good idea. How is she going to feed and put the baby down for a nap while taking care of a toddler? She's already gets stressed and overwhelmed just looking after the baby. Why put herself through more stress? I told her that I could not take the day off work and she would be alone taking care of both our kids. She said she really wanted to spend time with both the kids and felt like she doesn't see our toddler enough. Fine, no problem. If she wants to do this, it's up to her. I reiterated that I was not going to be around to help. Cut to this morning, I got up at midnight and at 4 a.m. to take care of the baby. I get both kids ready and make breakfast for everyone. I start work, and sure enough, 20 minutes after I started, I hear a wife trying to tell our toddler that she needs to go to the other room to put the baby down for nap. Of course, the toddler doesn't want to leave her side. The toddler starts crying. I can hear my wife getting frustrated. Wife finally leaves to put the baby down, comes back. She now has to juggle back and forth trying to settle the baby, putting the pacifier back in. We are starting to sleep, shaming the toddler who wants all of her attention. Finally, baby is settled. Wife is obviously stressed and tired, and it is 9:45 a.m. She comes into my office where I am working and asks, did I not hear her struggling? Why did I not come to help? Am I the asshole for telling her I told you so, that I would not be around to help, and this is what you get, that she should have let me bring our toddler to daycare? Honestly, yeah, like, I'm going to say buddy is not the asshole. Because, like, if Buddy was at the job working 9 to 5, if he was at out of the house from 9 to 5 working, this would have been her brilliant little idea, and she would have been stuck all by herself. She wouldn't have him watching the kid while she goes to pick up her other kid. Like, I applaud mom for wanting to spend time with her kids. I really do. I don't think it's bad that she wants to spend time with her children. That's not a problem. And I love that she actually wants to spend time with her children. But children, especially little children, are incredibly difficult. And the fact that she has her husband working at home and is able to work at home as much as she is, I think, see, and this is difficult for me to say because having been a mom and having had postpartum anxiety and postpartum depression, I can see where she's coming from, that she's frustrated and she's tired. I can absolutely see that. So my empathy is for mom. And I get it, that she wants to spend time with her kids, but it's frustrating and very difficult to have two little kids, one who is 2 and one who is 5 months, and trying to juggle that at the same time. I absolutely get that. Time. When she was told that Buddy has to work and that he can't help her with the kids because he has to work, she's being a little bit, I want to say entitled, but at the same time, she's not understanding either. She's so used to him being there for her and being the dad that he, you know, on one hand should be, but on the other hand, he's going above and beyond. Dude is going above and beyond being a supportive partner and a supportive father, being a father, while he's juggling a whole ass job. But it's like, at the same time, ma'am, I get it. You're tired and you're frustrated. But like, you were told that if you do this, you're going to have to do this on your own. Anyway, off to the comments. Not the asshole. Work from home is work, and you told her beforehand what your abilities were. OP may need to go back to the office. Wife neither understands nor respects work time. Not a peaceful environment to work in, coupled wife the wife coming in complaining or asking for help. Honestly, this should be top comment. So many regard work from home as being able to include home responsibilities. It doesn't. Going to the office would force mama to take care of herself more and nap. See, I don't understand why she didn't get the toddler in there to do this too. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah, a lot of the comments are just like, I am just completely blown away that like everybody is in unison here with the comments. Wife needs to learn to manage 2 kids. Millions of people do it all the time. Give him something to play with, put a movie on or something, but she needs to manage things better or take the toddler back to daycare. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. It's not the asshole. I love that she wants to spend more time with her kids, but if you have your kid in daycare and you're used to that routine and suddenly you have this kid and you're expected to make your husband the immediate daycare provider, that's not how it works. He's working his job. So if you can't handle it, put your son back in daycare or start learning how to handle it. Because like, you took him out of his routine. You created that routine for him. Then you took him out of his routine because of course he's going to want to spend time with mom. Of course he is. That's a very natural thing. That's a good thing that he wants to spend time with his mom. But you and as an adult need to learn how to cope. You and an adult need to learn how to deal with this because you wanting to make a decision and then putting it off on your husband who's trying to work to bring money in to your guys' pockets when he already takes like lunchtime and to watch your guys' youngest so you can go get him from daycare, like dude does more than enough. You need to step up, mama. And that's hard to hear. That's hard to hear, especially when you're, you know, physically recovering from having a baby. You're emotionally vulnerable. You're probably tired. He's tired too, but you're tired. And then there's all the pressures of society on top of it. And then going through, you know, the transition of, you know, becoming a mom of one to becoming the mom of two, it's difficult. It's difficult. But you need to step up. You need to step up. I'm going to agree here with everybody here that dude is not the asshole. Some are saying, I told you how so wasn't necessary, but most certainly not the asshole. And it's like, but, you know, yeah, for empathy's sake, the I told you so wasn't necessary, but, you know, You told her so. Ooh, this is interesting. Last one. Am I the asshole for not punishing my 7-year-old for her play relationships? What? My husband and I have a 7-year-old daughter together, Layla. A few months ago, Layla got a quote-unquote boyfriend, Lucas. They are both 7, so it's obviously not a real relationship. They just hold hands sometimes, and they drew each other hearts for Valentine's Day. This week, Layla was apparently holding hands with another boy who sent Layla a Valentine's love letter, and Lucas took offense to it. We found out because Lucas's parents called us to tell Lucas won't be coming over to us this Saturday like it was originally planned because he's mad at Layla. My husband wants us to punish Layla and wants me to have a talk with her about faithfulness. At first, I thought he was joking, but no, he was serious. He says that Layla cheated on Lucas and I, as her mother should do something about it. I told my husband that Layla is 7, not a cheater, and I won't treat her as such. But then he accused me of raising a cheater, encouraging bad behavior. Am I the asshole for not wanting to punish Layla? Okay, so top comment. She's 7. It's ridiculous to call her a cheater. At the same time, you can sit her down and explain why Lucas is upset and doesn't want to see her. That's more than enough of a lesson. Yeah, I would say so. And maybe explain to her that, you know, the whole boyfriend-girlfriend thing is not appropriate for their age. They're 7. Like, I understand them, you know, if any parents want to, like, educate their children about the concept, absolutely. If that's what they've already started engaging in, most certainly educate them about the concept. But, like, what the fuck? Calling her a cheater? She's 7, bro. She's 7. Like, this is what happens when you have children raising children. This is what happens when you have babies raising babies. And I'm not talking about babies as in like 18-year-olds. I'm talking about as in like mentally. Mentally, you have children raising children. And then you're projecting onto your children. Like, you're calling yourself, what the, having been around 7-year-old kids more than enough, that just blows my mind that an adult would want to confront a 7-year-old about this and do that kind of psychological damage. I mean, it's bad enough that like the 7 years are the formative years, and after seven, like 4 years old is like the biggest building blocks, but like 7 years is the formative years kind of thing. Well, not necessarily formative, but like the first seven years are the most important of all of the childhood. But if you don't do it right, like you can set your kid up for major failure in the future. Because they're going to have unhealthy coping skills and not know how to deal with it, and they're going to have trauma and all this other stuff. That's not to say that they can't, you know, fix it as an adult, but, you know, we should generally not be trying to traumatize our kids at, you know, younger ages. And that, anyway, just, wow, okay. Yeah, everyone is saying talk to Layla about your feelings, when really the important advice is talk to your husband about not being an abusive and unhinged father. Yeah? Yeah, I would concur with that. Last comment here. What is happening with these comments framing this as analogous an adult relationship? This isn't about faithfulness and cheating. This is about very common dynamic among children, jealousy and exclusion. Leaving someone out, which engenders jealousy responses. Kid antics emerge in various directions, and the BFGF language isn't the point. Explain to Layla that Lucas is feeling jealous. This isn't because she's done anything wrong. It's a natural feeling people need to learn to contend with, and that often comes from feeling excluded or unvalued. Well, this is something that she's done wrong because she was engaging in relationship. I mean, outside of the BFGF label, but she was doing these things with Lucas, and Lucas has the impression that they were supposed to only be doing these things together, but then when somebody else stepped into the mix, it created, you know, obviously not that. So it isn't because she's done anything wrong. Well, she has done something wrong, but regardless, kids get envious and these things happen. I mean, adults get envious too, but anyway. Perhaps consider encouraging her to be inclusive of Lucas rather than pursuing friendship dynamics that are just about two friends at once. It'd be nice if Lucas' parents were having the same conversation with him. Layla should not be getting the message as a 7-year-old girl that it is not her job to make the men around her comfortable and happy. She should be getting the message that friends care about each other and try to include one another. Definitely don't micromanage little people dynamics. So, like, first of all, yeah, in my opinion, it's right up there with sexualizing a child, not okay, let her be a kid and continue to express her true feelings. I would personally approach Layla and ask her what her understanding is in this dynamic, because it could very much be this case that, you know, she's just being a child and the children are just being children and trying to explore these dynamics, but at the same time, they're understanding might be a little bit more in depth than one is left to assume, that, you know, this could be Lucas's understanding, even though it's not as in depth as, you know, somebody who's a little bit older or like an adult. But it would be important to gain perspective from your kid, their perspective and what's going on here, and then proceed accordingly going with that. That's just my opinion. Oh, wild. Absolutely wild. Holy crap. I'm going to read, and we're going to go to Twitter. Everything is wild. Okay, let's hop over to Twitter. So here's the first thing I see on Twitter. Insider paper. China citizens told to find shelter after it looked like it started to rain worms. Like, legitimately, there's just worms falling out of the freaking sky. And it's, like, raining or snowing. It's snowing. That's snow. And there's just worms everywhere, all over these cars. You can find that on the insider paper that was posted 6 hours ago. Wild. So... oh, just in, 11 hours ago, U.S. believes Russia is trying to incite an insurrection against the government in Moldova, of course. Meanwhile, the government in the United States is blowing up the pipeline from Russia and now building a pipeline in Alaska and going to sell that to Europe. So... neat stuff, boy. Keep going down the line here. God, these, Twitter is just on fire. I don't even know what to say. Uh-oh. Apparently there was a flood. I don't even know where this is. It's on Vids Go Hard. What would you do in this situation? It's like the ocean like coming in and like completely destroying. Holy smokes. It just like came in and completely destroyed like the house on the beach and everybody's just like running. Oh my goodness. I hope everybody's okay. I don't think they were, because the force of the way that ocean came in and just completely destroyed that little like little bitty building where you go and buy your drinks and stuff. It just completely obliterated it. Whoa. Let's see what else is on Twitter. Am I doing, what, do I even want to bother? I don't even know at this point. The world is falling apart. Dee-dee-dee. Let's keep scrolling here. What is this? Tucker Carlson. Hold on. Let's see this.
He comes on and he's like, 11 years ago, the U.S. government reached out to me because I'm an expert on head injuries, on brain injuries, and they had all these court cases, family, U.S. service for 100, who had been killed by UFOs. The Department of Defense was refusing to give them death benefits for medical. And he's like, so they're, and he studied their brains. He got a call.
Whoa. That's wild. That's absolutely wild. That's what shared from Luke Rutkowski. UFOs with brain-smashing abilities or next-level weapons tests? I don't know what that entails, but, like, not going to lie, when I say I'm a little nervous about that, because here I am. You know, if you've been paying attention to the whole, you know, Project Blue Beam, I'm sure everybody's talking about it this last little while. Who isn't talking about it, I guess one could say, about aliens landing and, you know, Project Blue Beam and all this other stuff. We don't know if aliens are actually real. Some people say aliens are real. Some people say it's Project Blue Beam. We don't even freaking know. All I know is things are happening, and you don't even know what to believe at this point, because everything the government tells you is a lie, and it's always being disproven, or it's a half-truth, or it's a half-lie, and then later you find out, well, this part was true, but this part was a lie, and I don't even freaking know. Everything is just getting to be absolutely wild. I'm not even going to lie. But, yeah, it's kind of freaky that Tucker Carlson is talking about that, because, like, Tucker Carlson just, like, released just a couple days ago that, oh, here it is. Elon Musk on Twitter. Chansley got 4 years in prison for a nonviolent police escorted tour. Dave Chappelle was violently assaulted on stage by a guy with a knife. That guy got a $3,000 fine and no prison time. Greg Price had shared on March 6th, breaking never-before-seen video of January 6th shows Jacob Chansley, the QAnon shaman, being led to the Capitol by police the entire time he was in the building. So either this is true, either this is entirely true, and they did this, and Buddy served jail time, or allegedly served jail time for it, or this is AI. And at the point, it's just like, I don't even know, because like somebody had shared a screenshot, and they're like, where's the police in this image? Well, isn't that good to know? You know, it's just, everything is so questionable right now that we don't know what's up and what's down. Actually, I'm going to go Google something really quick. AI. AI. Reading study. Artificial intelligence is learning how to read your mind. AI recreates what people see, reading their brain scans. Okay, so it's on science.org. So this article posted 3 days ago, 7th of March, 2023, by Kamal Nahas on science.org. AI recreates what people see by reading their brain scan. So if you head over, actually, you know what? I will post this article right now, D3, in the description. Hold on. Okay, hold on. Let me see. AI, give me 1 second. I'll post this right now so people can see it. Here we go. Oh, where'd my... Shit. Apparently that's not going to work because the writing is white. The writing is white. Okay, that's a problem. So we're just going to post a link. We're just going to post a link right now. Done. AI reads brain scan. Whoops. Brain scan. Done. Save. There we go. Link number one. Okay, here we go, guys. Holy smokes. Okay. As your neuroscientists struggle to demystify how the human brain converts what our eyes see into mental images, artificial intelligence, AI, has been getting better at mimicking that feat. A recent study is scheduled to be presented at an upcoming computer can read brain scans and recreate largely realistic versions of images a person has seen. As technology develops, researchers say, it could have numerous applications, from exploring how various animal species perceive the world to perhaps one day recording human dreams and aiding communication in people with paralysis. Many labs have used AI to read brain scans and recreate images a subject has recently seen, such as human faces and photos of landscape. The new study marks the first time an AI algorithm called Stable Diffusion, developed by a German group and publicly released in 2022, has been used to do this. Stable Diffusion is similar to other text-to-image generative AI such as DALL-E2 and Midjourney, which produced new images from text prompts after being trained on billions of images associated with text descriptions. For the new study, a group in Japan added additional training to the standard Stable Diffusion system, linking additional text descriptions about thousands of photos to brain patterns elicited when those photos were observed by participant AI algorithms to decipher brain scans, which had to be trained on large data sets. Stable Diffusion was able to get more out of less training for each participant by incorporating photo captions into the algorithm. It's a novel approach and incorporates textual and visual information to decipher the brain, says Ariel Goldstein, a cognitive neuroscientist at Princeton University who is not involved with the work. The AI algorithm makes use of information gathered from different regions of the brain involved in image perception, such as occipital, and temporal lobes, according to Yu Takagai, a systems neuroscientist at Osaka University who worked on the experiment. The system interpreted information from functional magnetic resonance imaging, brain scans, which detect changes in blood flow to active regions of the brain. When people look at a photo, the temporal lobes predominantly register information about the content of the image, people, objects, scenery, whereas the occipital lobe predominantly registers information about layout and perspective, such as the scale and position of the content. All of this information is recorded by the fMRI, as it captures peaks in brain activity, and these patterns can be reconverted into an imitation image using AI. In the new study, the researchers added additional training to the Stable Diffusion algorithm using an online data set provided by the University of Minnesota, which consisted of brain scans from four participants as they each viewed a set of 10,000 photos. A portion of these brain scans from the same four participants were not used in training and were used to test the AI system later. Each AI-generated image started out as noise, reminiscent of TV static, and replaces the noise with distinguishable features as the Stable Diffusion algorithm compares a person's brain activity patterns from viewing a photo with the patterns in its training data set. The system effectively generates an image depicting the contents, layout, and perspectives of the photo being viewed. Takagai says the new system was more efficient than previous ones, required less fine-tuning, and could be trained with a smaller data set. Brain activity, predominantly in the occipital lobe, provided enough information to recreate the layout and perspective of the photos being viewed, the researchers found, but the algorithm struggled to recapitulate objects such as a clock tower from the real photo, instead created abstract figures. One approach to tackling this problem could be to use larger training data sets that could train the algorithm to predict more details, but the fMRI data set was too limited for this, the Japanese team says. Instead, the researchers circumvented this issue by harnessing keywords from image captions that accompanied the photos in the Minnesota fMRI data set. For example, one of the training photos contained a clock tower, the pattern of the brain activity from the scan would be associated with that object. This map pattern was exhibited once more by the study participant during the testing stage. The system would feed the object's keyword into Stable Diffusion's normal text-to-image generator, and a clock tower would be incorporated into recreated image, following the layout and perspective indicated by the brain pattern, resulting in a convincing imitation of the real photo. Importantly, the Stable Diffusion algorithm doesn't receive a text prompt directly from the test data. It can only infer that the object is present in the brain pattern matches one seen in the training data. This limits the object it can recreate to those present in the photos during the training. Finally, the researchers tested their system on additional brain scans from the same participants when they viewed a separate set of photos, including a toy bear, airplane, clock, and train. By comparing the brain patterns from those images with those produced by the photos, In the training data set, the AI system was able to produce convincing imitations of the novel photos. The accuracy of this new method is impressive, said Iris Groen, the neuroscientist at the University of Amsterdam, who is not involved with the work. However, the AI system was only tested on brain scans from the same four people who provided the training brain scans and expanded it to other individuals would require retraining the system on their brain scans. So it may take a while for this technology to become widely available. Nonetheless, Groen argues that the diffusion models have an unprecedented ability to generate realistic images and could create new opportunities for cognitive neuroscience research. Shinji Nishimoto, another systems neuroscientist at Osaka University who worked on the study, hopes that with further refinements, the technology could be used to intercept imagined thoughts and dreams, or allow scientists to understand how differently other animals perceive reality. Holy wow. That's, Yep, that's all I'm going to say. We're going to take a quick commercial, and I'm going to read the section to you of 1984. That scares the crap out of me, because when I read this, I immediately think of 1984, the part where Winston is in the Ministry of Love, and that what's-his-name is sitting there telling him everything that he can, you know, whatever. Okay, we'll be right back.
Paul, where is your letter of recommendation?
Pete, the Corinthians hearts are my letter.
Paul, that is utter bull malarkey. Daniel 11:32-36 warned us of the one who will deceive with flatteries, saying that we are free from the law. There is a freedomizer broadcast called Everlasting Covenant Study Free from Paul. It airs from noon to 3 p.m. Pacific, 1 to 4 Mountain, and 2 to 5 Central every Saturday. Join Rachel Hodge 3 to 6 Eastern Saturdays by calling 319-527-6208.
I will not call 319-527-6208. Crafty fellow that I am, I should have caught her with trickery.
No chance, Paul. Everlasting Covenant Study Free from Paul airs noon to 3 Pacific on Saturdays.
We talk a lot about the kingdom here, and we talk a lot about what most churches are afraid to talk about or don't even know to talk about, which is what the first century church was really doing. But just talking about it is not enough. We encourage everybody to join us in their local neighborhoods, in their local communities, to find out more about what they can do to seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Gather with others who are already starting this road or starting to turn around and do things differently. Join us on thelivingnetwork.org or at hisholychurch.org. Go to the network links or go to preparingyou.com. Join the network there. It's all the same. And we'll try to hook you up with people in your local area. They will not be perfect. They don't walk on water. They are not necessarily saints. But they are talking about seeking the kingdom of God and His righteousness. And join us on Facebook. Facebook.com, His Holy Church, all one word. Join us there. We'll give you updates so you can start doing some studying and thinking about these things and start looking into these things for yourselves. But it's just not enough to sit and listen or to talk about or to say. You must become a doer of the word.
Please check out the Barefoot is Legal radio show right here on Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That is 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific Time, as we show you all about your barefoot rights and living a barefoot lifestyle. And for more information about the 501c3 nonprofit Barefoot is Legal, please check out barefootislegal.org. Hey everyone, come check out the Proof Negative Radio Show here on FreedomizerRadio.com, Monday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the Pacific Coast as we fight the New World Order and rock the health freedom world together.
Alrighty, everybody, we are back on Open World. I am going to take this opportunity to read part three of the 1984 George Orwell. So hope you guys are chilling because, like, yeah, chapter one of part three. I'm not going to read, I'll read like chapter one, chapter two, or whatever. I'm not going to read too much more than that, but sit down. Hope you have a tea ready. Here we go. He did not know where he was. Presumably he was in the Ministry of Love, but there was no way of making certain. He was in a high-ceilinged, windowless cell and walls of glittering white porcelain. Concealed lamps flooded the cold light, and there was a low, steady humming sound, which he supposed had been something to do with the air supply. A bench or shelf, just wide enough to sit on, ran around the wall, broken only by the door, and at the opposite end of the door, a lavatory pan with no wooden seat. There were four telescreens, one on each wall. There was a dull aching in his belly. It had been there ever since they had bundled him into the closed van and driven him away. But he was also hungry, with a gnawing, unwholesome kind of hunger. It might be 24 hours since he had eaten. It might be 36. He still did not know, and probably never would know, whether it had been the morning or the evening when they had arrested him. Since he was arrested, he had not been fed. He sat as still as he could on a narrow bench with his hands crossed on his knee. He had already learned to sit still. If you had made unexpected movements, they yelled at you from the telescreen. But the craving for food was growing upon him. What he had longed for above all was a piece of bread. He had an idea that there was a fruit breadcrumbs in his pocket on his overalls. If it was even possible, he thought, this because from time to time something seemed to tickle his leg, that there might be a sizable bit of crust there. In the end of the temptation to find out overcame his fear, he slipped his hand into his pocket. Smith, yelled a voice from the telescreen. 6079, Smith W., hands out of the pockets on the cells. He sat still again, his hands crossed his knee. But being brought there, he had been taken to another place, which must have been an ordinary prison or a temporary lockup used by the patrols. On here. He did not know how long he had been there, some hours at any rate, no clocks, no daylight, and it was hard to gauge the time. A noisy, evil-smelling place. They had put him into a cell similar to the one he was in now, but filthily dirty, and at all times crowded by 10 or 15 people. The majority of them were common criminals, but there was a few political prisoners among them. He had sat silent against the wall, jostled by dirty bodies, too preoccupied by fear and the pain of his belly to take much interest in his surroundings, but still noticing the astonishing difference in demeanor between the party prisoners and the others. The party prisoners were always silent and terrified, but the ordinary criminals seemed to care nothing for anybody. They yelled insults at the guards, fought back fiercely when their belongings were impounded, wrote obscene words on the floor, ate smuggled food, which they produced from mysterious hiding places in their clothes, and even shouted down the telescreen when it tried to restore order. On the other hand, some of them seemed to be on good terms with the guards, calling them by nicknames and tried to wheedle cigarettes through the spy hole in the door. The guards, too, treated the common criminals with a certain forbearance. Even when they had to handle them roughly, there was much talk about the forced labor camps to which most of the prisoners expected to be sent. It was all right in the camps, he gathered, so long as you had good contacts and knew the ropes. There was bribery, favoritism, and racketeering of every kind. There was homosexuality and prostitution. There was even illicit alcohol distilled from potatoes. The positions of trust were only given to the common criminals, especially the gangsters and the murderers who formed a sort of aristocracy. All the dirty jobs were done by the politicals. Come and go of prisoners of every description, drug peddlers, thieves, bandits, black marketeers, drunks, and prostitutes. Some of the drunks were so violent that the other prisoners had to combine to suppress them. An enormous wreck of a woman around age 60 with great tumbling breasts and thick coils of white hair had come down in her struggles, was carried in, kicking and shouting, by four guards who had hold of her at each corner. they wrenched off the boots with which she had been kicking them and dumped her down across Winston's lap, almost breaking his thigh bones. The woman hoisted herself up and followed them out with a yell of bastards. Then, noticing that she was sitting on something uneven, she slid off Winston's knees to the bench. "Beg your pardon, dearie," she said. "I wouldn't have sat on you, only the buggers put me there." "They don't know how to treat an old lady, do they?" she paused, patting her breast and belt. "Pardon," she said. "I ain't myself quite." She leaned forward and vomited copiously on the floor. "That's better," she said, leaning back and closed her eyes. "Never kept it down, that's what I say. Never keep it down, that's what I say. Get it up while it's fresh on your stomach, like." She revived, turned to have another look at Winston, and seemed immediately to take a fancy to him. She put a vast arm around his shoulder and drew him towards her, breathing beer and vomit in his face. "What's your name, dearie?" she said. "Smith," said Winston. "Smith," said the woman. "That's funny. My name's Smith, too. Why," she said, she added sentimentally, "I might be your mother." She might, though, thought Winston, be his mother. She was about the right age and physique, and it was probable that people changed somewhat after 20 years of being in a forced labor camp. No one else had spoken to him. To a surprising extent, the ordinary criminals ignored the party prisoner, the Politz, they called them, with a sort of uninterested contempt. The party prisoners seemed terrified of speaking to anybody and, above all, speaking to one another. Only once, when two party members, both women, were pressed close together on the bench, he overheard amid the din of voices a few hurriedly spoken words, and in particular a reference to something called Room 101, which he did not understand. It might be 2 or 3 hours ago that they had brought him there. The dull pain in his belly never went away, but sometimes it grew better and sometimes worse, and his thoughts expanded or contracted accordingly. When it grew worse, he thought of only pain itself, but in his desire of food. When it grew better, panic took a hold of him. There were moments when he foresaw the things that would happen to him with such actuality, and his heart galloped and his breath stopped. He felt the smashed truncheons of his elbow and iron-shod boots in his shin, groveling on the floor, screaming for mercy through broken teeth. He had hardly thought of Julia. He could not fix his mind on her. He loved her and would not betray her, but that was only a fact, known as he knew the rules of arithmetic. He felt no love for her, and he hardly even wondered what was happening to her. He thought oftener of O'Brien with a flickering hope. O'Brien might know that he had been arrested. The Brotherhood, he said, never tried to save its members, but there was a razor blade. They would send the razor blade if they could. It would be perhaps 5 seconds before the guard could rush into the cell. The blade would bite into him with a sort of burning coldness, and even the fingers that held it would be cut to the bone. Everything came back to his sick body, which shrank trembling from the smallest pain. He was not certain he would use the razor blade, even if he got the chance. It was more natural to exist from moment to moment, accepting another 10 minutes' life, even with certainty that there was torture at the end of it. Sometimes he tried to calculate the number of porcelain bricks in the wall of the cell. It should have been easy, but he always lost count at some point or another. And then he wondered where he was and what time of day it was. At one moment, he felt certain it was broad daylight outside, and the next equally certain it was pitch darkness. In this place, he knew instinctively the lights would never be turned out. It was the place of with no darkness. He saw now why O'Brien seemed to recognize the illusion. In the Ministry of Love, there was no windows. His cell might be at the heart of the building or against his outer wall. It might be 10 floors below ground or 30 feet above. He moved himself mentally from place to place and tried to determine by the feeling of his body whether he was perched high in the air or buried deep underground. There was a sound of marching boots outside. The steel door opened with a clang. A young officer, a trim black uniform figure who seemed to glitter all over with polished leather, whose pale, straight-featured face was like a wax mask, stepped smartly through the doorway. He motioned to the guards outside to bring in the prisoner they were leading. The poet Ampleforth shambled into the cell. The door clanged shut again. Ampleforth made one or two uncertain movements from side to side, as though having some idea that there was another door to go out of, and began to wander up and down the cell. He had not noticed Winston's presence. His troubled eyes were gazing at the wall about a meter above the level of Winston's head. He was sure shoeless, large, dirty toes were sticking out of holes in his socks. He was also several days away from a shave. A scrubby beard covered his face to his cheekbones, giving him an air of ruffianism that went oddly with his large, weak frame and a nervous movement. Winston roused himself, and a little from his lethargy, he must speak to Appleforth and risk the yell of the temptilla screen. It was even conceivable that Ampleforth was the bearer of the razor blade. Ampleforth, he said. There was no yell from the telescreen. Ampleforth paused, mildly started. His eyes focused themselves slowly on Winston. Ah, Smith, he said. You too. What are you in for? To tell you the truth, he sat down awkwardly on the bench opposite of Winston. There's only one offense, is there not? He said. And have you committed it? Apparently I have. He put a hand on his forehead and pressed his temples for a moment as though trying to remember something. These things happen, he began vaguely. I have been able to recall one instance, a possible instance. It was an indiscretion, undoubtedly. We were producing a definitive edition of the poems of Kipling. I allowed the word God to remain at the end of a line. I could not help it, he added, most indignantly. He raised his face to look at Winston. It was impossible to change the line. The rhyme was rod. Do you realize there are only 12 rhymes to rod in the entire language? For days I had racked my brain. There was no other rhyme. The expression on his face changed. The annoyance passed out of it. For a moment he looked almost pleased. A sort of intellectual warmth, the joy of the pedant who had found some useless fact, shone through the dirt and scrubby hair. Has it ever occurred to you, he said, that the whole history of English poetry has been determined by the fact that the English language lacks rhymes? No, that particular thought had never occurred to Winston, nor in the circumstances did it strike him as very important or interesting. Do you know what time of day it is, he said. Ampleforth looked startled again. I had hardly thought about it. They arrested me. It could have been 2 days ago, perhaps three. His eyes flitted around the wall, as though he half expected to find a window somewhere. There is no difference between day and night in this place. I do not see how one can calculate the time. They talked disuluredly, for some minutes. Then, without apparent reason, a yell from the telescreen bade them to be silent. Winston sat quietly, his hands crossed. Ampleforth, too large to sit in comfort on the narrow bench, fidgeted from side to side, clasping his lank hands first around one knee, then around the other. The telescreen barked at him to keep still. Time passed, 20 minutes, an hour. It was difficult to judge. Once more, there was a sound of boots outside. Winston's entrails contracted. Soon, very soon, perhaps in 5 minutes, perhaps now, the trample of boots would mean that his own turn had come. The door opened. The cold-faced young officer stepped into the cell. With a brief movement of the hand, he indicated Ampleforth. Room 101, he said. Ampleforth marched clumsily out between the guard, his face vaguely perturbed but uncomprehending. That seemed like a long time past. The pain in Winston's belly had revived. His mind sagged round and round on the same trick, like a ball falling again and again into the same series of slots. He had only 6 thoughts: the pain in his belly, a piece of bread, the blood on the screaming, O'Brien, Julia, the razor blade. There was another spasm in his entrails. The heavy boots were approaching. As the door opened, the wave of air that it created brought in a powerful smell of cold sweat. Parsons walked into the cell. He was wearing khaki shorts and a sports shirt. This time, Winston was startled in the self-forgetfulness. You here? He said. Parsons gave Winston a glance, in which there was neither interest nor surprise, but only misery. He began walking jerkily up and down, evidently unable to keep still. Each time he straightened his pudgy knees, it was apparent that they were trembling. His eyes had a wide open, staring look, as though he could not prevent himself from gazing at something in the middle distance. What are you in for? Said Winston. His voice implied at once a complete admission of his guilt and a sort of incredulous horror that such a word could be applied to himself. He paused opposite of Winston and began eagerly appealing to him. You don't think they'll shoot me, do you, old chap? You don't shoot you if you haven't actually done anything, only thoughts which you can't help. I know they give you a fair hearing. Oh, I trust them for that. They'll know my record, won't they? You know what kind of chap I was. Not a bad chap and in my way. Not brainy, of course, but keen. I tried to do my best for the party, didn't I? I'll get off with 5 years, don't you think? Or even 10? A chap like me could make a pretty useful in a labor camp. They wouldn't shoot me for going off the rails just once. Are you guilty? Said Winston. Of course I'm guilty, cried Parsons with a servile glance at the telescreen. You don't think the party would arrest an innocent man, do you? His frog-like face grew calmer and even took on a slightly sanctimonious expression. Thought crime is a dreadful thing, old man, he said sententiously. It's insidious. It can get a hold of you without your even knowing it. Do you know how it got a hold of me? In my sleep. Yes, that's a fact. There I was, working away, trying to do my bit, knew I had any bad stuff in my mind at all. Then I started talking in my sleep. Do you know what they heard me saying? He sank his voice until someone who is obliged for medical reasons to utter obscenity. Down was Big Brother. Yes, I said that. Said it over and over again, it seems. Between you and me, old man, I'm glad they got me before I went any further. Do you know what I'm going to say to them when I go up to the tribunal? Thank you, I'm going to say. Thank you for saving me before it was too late. Who denounced you? Said Winston. It was my little daughter, said Parsons, with a sort of doleful pride. She listened at the keyhole, heard what I was saying, and nipped off to the patrols the very next day. Pretty small for a nipper of 7, hey? I don't bear any grudge for it. I'm proud of her. It shows I brought her up in the right spirit anyway. He made a few more jerky movements up and down several times, casting a longing glance at the lavatory pan. Then he suddenly ripped down his shorts. Excuse me, old man, he said, I can't help it. It's the waiting. He plumped his large posterior on the lavatory pan. Winston covered his face with his hands. Smith, yelled the voice from the telescreen. 6079, Smith W, uncover your face. No face is covered in the cells. Winston uncovered his face. Parsons viewed the lavatory loudly and abundantly. Then it turned out that the plug was defective and the cell stank abominably for hours after. Parsons was removed. More prisoners came and went mysteriously. One, a woman, was consigned to room 101, and Winston noticed seemed to shrivel and turn a different color when she heard the words. A time came when, if it had been morning when they were all brought here, it would have been afternoon, or if it had been afternoon, then it would be midnight. There were 6 prisoners in the cell, men and women. All sat very still. Opposite Winston, there sat a man with a toothy face, exactly like that of some large, harmless rodent. His fat, mottled cheeks were so pouched at the bottom that it was difficult not to believe that he had little stores of food tucked away in there. His pale gray eyes flitted timorously from face to face and turned quickly away again when he had caught anyone's eye. The door opened and another prisoner was brought in, whose appearance sent a momentary chill through Winston. He was a commonplace, mean-looking man who had been an engineer or technician of some kind. But that was startling. What was startling is the emancipation on his face. It was like a skull. Because of its thinness, the mouth and eyes looked disproportionately large, and the eyes seemed to be filled with murderous, unappeasable hatred of somebody or something. The man sat down on the bench at a little distance from Winston. Winston did not look at him again, but the tormented skull-like face was vivid in his mind, as though it had been straight in front of his eyes. Suddenly he realized what was the matter. The man was dying of starvation. The same thought seemed to occur almost simultaneously from everyone in the cell. There was a very faint stirring all the way around the bench. The eyes of the chinless man flitted around towards the skull-faced man, then turning guiltily away, then being dragged back by an irresistible attraction. Presently, he began to fidget in his seat. At last, he stood up, waddled clumsily across the cell, dug down in his pocket of his overalls. With an abashed air, he held out a grimy piece of bread to the skull-faced man. There was a furious, deafening roar from the telescreen. The chinless man jumped in his tracks. The skull-faced man had quickly thrust out his hands behind his back, as though demonstrating to all the world that he refused the gift. Bumstead, roared the voice. 2713 Bumstead J, let fall the piece of bread. The chinless man dropped the piece of bread on the floor. Remain standing where you are, said the voice. Face the door, no movement. The chinless man obeyed. His large, pouchy cheeks were quivering uncontrollably. The door clanged open. As the young officer entered and stepped aside, there emerged from behind him a short, stumpy guard with enormous arms and shoulders. He took a stand opposite of the chinless man, and then, from a signal from the officer, let free a frightful blow with all his weight from his body behind it, full in the chinless man's mouth. The force of it seemed to knock him across the floor. His body was flung across the cell and fetched up against the base of the lavatory seat. For a moment, he lay as though stunned, with dark blood oozing from his mouth. Hold on, he's making sure. Okay. And nose. Very faint whimpering or squeaking, which seemed unconscious, came out of him. Then he rolled over and raised himself unsteadily on his hands and knees. Amid a stream of blood and saliva, and two halves of a dental plate fell out of his mouth. The prisoner sat very still, their hands crossed on their knees. The chinless man climbed back into his place. Down one side of his face, the flesh was darkening. His mouth had swollen into a shapeless cherry-colored mass with a black hole in the middle of it. From time to time, a little blood dripped on the breast from his onto the breast of his overalls. His gray eyes still flitted from face to face, more guiltily than ever, as though he was trying to discover how much the others despised him for his humiliation. The door opened with a small gesture. The officer indicated the skull-faced man. Room 101, he said. There was a gasp and a flurry at Winston's side. The man had actually flung himself on his knees to the floor with his hands clasped together. "Comrade, officer," he cried, "you don't have to take me to that place. Haven't I told you already? What else is it that you want to know? There's nothing I wouldn't confess, nothing. Just tell me what it is, and I'll confess straight off. Write it down, and I'll sign it. Anything. Not room 101. Room 101, said the officer, face already very pale, turned a color Winston would not have believed possible. It was definitely, unmistakably, a shade of green. "Do anything to me," he yelled. "You've been starving me for weeks. Finish it off. Let me die. Shoot me. Hang me. Sentence me to 25 years. Is there somebody else you want me to give away? Just say who it is, and I'll tell you anything you want. I don't care who it is or what you do to them. I've got a wife and three children. The biggest of them isn't 6 years old. You can take the whole lot of them and cut their throats in front of my eyes, and I'll stand by and watch, but not room 101. Room 101, said the officer. The man looked frantically around at the other prisoners as though with some idea that he could put another victim in his place. His eyes settled on the smashed face of the chinless man. He flung out a lean arm. "That's the one you ought to be taking, not me," he shouted. "You didn't hear what he was saying after they bashed his face. Give me a chance and I'll tell you every word of it. He's the one that's against the party, not me." The guard stepped forward. The man's face rose to a shriek. "You didn't kill him," he repeated. "Something's wrong with him, with the telescreen. He's the one you want. Take him, not me." The two sturdy guards had stooped to take him by the arms, and just at that moment he flung himself across the door of the cell and grabbed one of the iron legs and supported the bench he had set up, wordlessly howling like an animal. The guards took hold of him to wrench him loose, but he clung on with an astonishing strength. For perhaps 20 seconds they were hauling at him. The prisoners sat quiet, their hands crossed on their knees, looking straight in front of them. The howling stopped. The man had no breath left for anything except hanging on. Then there was a different kind of cry. The kick from the guard's boots had broken the fingers on one of his hands. He dragged them to his feet. "Room 101, said the officer. The man was let out, walking unsteadily, with head sunken, nursing his crushed hand, and the fight had all gone out of him. A long time passed. If it had been midnight when the skull-faced man was taken away, it was morning. If morning, it was afternoon. Winston was alone, and he had been alone for hours. The pain of sitting on the narrow bench was such that often he got up and walked about, unreproved by the telescreen. The piece of bread still lay where the chinless man had dropped it. In the beginning, it needed a hard effort not to look at it, but presently hunger gave way to thirst. His mouth was sticky and evil-tasting. The humming sound of the unveiling white light induced a sort of faintness, an empty feeling inside his head. He would get up because the ache in his bones was no longer bearable, and then would sit down again almost at once because he was too dizzy to make sure of staying on his feet. Whenever his physical sensations were a little under control, the terror returned. Sometimes with a fading hope, he thought of O'Brien and the razor blade. It was thinkable that the razor blade might have arrived to conceal his food. if he was ever fed. More dimly he thought of Julia. Somewhere or other, she might be suffering perhaps far worse than he. She might be screaming in pain at this moment, he thought. If I could save Julia by doubling on my own pain, would I do it? Yes, I would. But it was merely an intellectual decision taken because he knew that he ought not to take it. He did not feel it. In this place, you could not feel anything except pain and foreknowledge of pain. Besides, was it possible when you were actually suffering it to wish for any reason that your own pain should increase? But that question was not answerable yet. The boots were approaching the door. The door opened. O'Brien came in. Winston started to his feet. The shock of the sight had driven all caution out of him. For the first time in many years, he forgot the presence of the telescreen. "They've got you, too," he cried. "They got me a long time ago," said O'Brien with a mild, almost regretful irony. He stepped aside. From behind him, there emerged a broad-chested guard with a long black truncheon in his hand. "You know this, Winston," said O'Brien. "Don't deceive yourself. You know it. You have always known it." Yes, he saw now, he had always known it, but there is no time to think of that. All he had eyes for was the truncheon in the guard's hand. It might fall anywhere, on the crown, on the tip of the ear, on the upper arm, on the elbow. He had slumped to his knees, almost paralyzed, collapsing the stricken elbow in his other hand. Everything had exploded in the yellow light. Inconceivable, inconceivable that one blow could cause such pain. The light cleared, and he could see the other two looking down on him. The guard was laughing at his contortions. One question at any rate was answered. Never, for any reason on earth, would you wish for an increase of pain. Of pain, you could only wish one thing, that it should stop. Nothing in the world was so bad as physical pain, and the face of pain, there was no heroes. No heroes, he thought over and over as he writhed on the floor, clutching uselessly at his disabled left arm. He was lying on something that felt like a camp bed, except it was higher off the ground, and he was fixed down in some way so he could not move. Light that seemed stronger than usual was falling on his face. O'Brien was standing at his side, looking down at him intently. On the other side of him stood a man with a white coat holding a hypodermic syringe. Even after his eyes were open, he took in his surroundings only gradually. He had the impression of swimming up to the room from some quite different world, a sort of underwater world beneath it. How long had he been down there, he did not know. Since the moment when they arrested him, he had not seen darkness or daylight. Besides, his memories were not continuous. There had been multiple times when consciousness, even the sort of consciousness that one has in sleep, had stopped dead and started again after several... But whether the intervals were of days or weeks or only seconds, there was no way of knowing. With that first blow on the elbow, the nightmare had started. Later, he was to realize that all that then happened was merely preliminary, a routine interrogation to which nearly all prisoners were subjected. There was a long range of crimes, espionage, sabotage, and the like, to which everyone had to confess as a matter of course. The confession was formality, though. The torture was real. How many times he had been beaten, how long the beatings had continued, he could not remember. Always there were five or six men in black uniforms at him simultaneously. Sometimes it was fists, sometimes it was truncheons, sometimes it was steel rods, sometimes it was boots. There were times when he rolled about on the floor as shamelessly as an animal writhing in his body this way and that in an endless, hopeless effort to dodge the kicks and simply inviting more and yet more kicks into his ribs, in his belly, on his elbows, in his shins, in his groin, in his testicles, on the bone, at the base of the spine. There were times when it went on and on until the cruel, wicked, unforgivable thing seemed to him not that the guards continued to beat him, but that he could not force himself into losing consciousness. There were times when his nerve so forsook him that he began to shouting for mercy even before the beating began, when the mere sight of a fist drawn for a blow was enough to make him pour forth a confession of real and imaginary crimes. There were other times when he started out with resolve of confessing nothing, when every word had been forced out of him between gasps of pain. There were times when he had feebly tried to compromise. When he said to himself, "I will confess, but not yet. I must hold out till the pain becomes unbearable." three more kicks, two more kicks, and then I will tell him what they want. Sometimes he was beaten till he could barely hardly stand, then flung like a sack of potatoes onto the stone floor of a cell, left to recuperate for a few hours, and then taken out and beaten again. There were longer periods of recovery. He remembered them dimly because they were spent chiefly in sleep or stupor. He remembered a cell with a plank bed, a sort of shelf sticking out of the wall, and a tin wash basin, and meals of hot soup and bread, and sometimes coffee. He remembered a surly barber arriving to scrape his chin and crop his hair, and businesslike, unsympathetic men in white coats, feeling his pulse, tapping his reflexes, turning up his eyelids, running harsh fingers over him in search of broken bones, and shooting needles into his arm to make him sleep. The beatings grew less frequent and became mainly a threat, a horror to which he could be sent back at any moment when his answers went unsatisfactory. His questioners now were not ruffians in black uniforms, but party intellectuals, little rotund men with quick movements and flashing spectacles who worked on him in relays over periods which lasted, he thought, he could not be sure, 10 or 12 hours in a stretch. These other questioners saw to it that he was in constant slight pain, but not in chiefly pain like they relied on. They slapped his face, wrung his ears, pulled his hair, made him stand on one leg, refused to leave him urinate, shone glaring lights in his face until his eyes ran with water. But the aim was to simply humiliate him and destroy his power of arguing and reasoning. Their real weapons were most merciless questioning that went on, hour after hour, tripping him up, laying traps for him, twisting everything that he said, convincing him at every step of lies and self-contradiction until he began weeping as much from shame as from nervous fatigue. Sometimes he would weep a half a dozen times in a single session. Most of the time they screamed abuse at him and threatened at every hesitation to deliver him over to the guards again, but sometimes they would suddenly change their tune, call him a comrade, appeal to him, in the name of Ingsoc and Big Brother, and ask him sorrowfully whether he had not enough loyalty to the party left to make him wish to undo the evil he had done. When his nerves were in rags after hours of questioning, even this appeal could reduce him to sniveling tears. In the end, the nagging voices broke him down more completely than the boots and fists of the guard. He began simply a mouth that uttered, a hand that signed whatever was demanded of him. Concern was to find out what they wanted him to confess, and then confess it quickly before the bullying started anew. He confessed to the assassination of eminent party members, the distribution of seditious pamphlets, embezzlement of public funds, sale of military secrets, sabotage of every kind. He confessed that he was a spy in the pay of the Eastasian government as far back as 1968. He confessed that he was a religious believer, an admirer of capitalism, and a sexual pervert. He confessed that he had murdered his wife, although he knew, with all his questioners must have known, that his wife was still alive. He confessed for the years that he had been in personal touch with Goldstein and had been a member of an underground organization which included almost every human being he had ever known. It was easier to confess everything and implicate everybody because, in a sense, it was all true. It was true that he had been the enemy of the party, and in his eyes, the party was no distinction between the thought and the deed. There were also memories of another kind. They stood out in his mind disconnectedly, the pictures of blackness all around them. He was in a cell which might have been either dark or light because he could see nothing except a pair of eyes. Near at hand, some kind of instrument was ticking slowly and regularly. The eyes grew larger and more luminous. Suddenly, he floated out of his seat, dived into his eyes, and was swallowed up. He was strapped into a chair surrounded by dials under dazzling lights. A man in a white coat was reading the dials. There was a tramp of heavy boots outside. The door clanged open. The wax-faced officer marched in, followed by two guards. Room 101, said the officer. The man in the white coat did not turn around. He did not look at Winston either. He was looking only at the dials. He was rolling down a mighty corridor, a kilometer wide, full of glorious golden light, roaring with laughter and shouting out confessions at the top of his voice. He was confessing everything, even in the things he had succeeded in holding back under torture. He was relating the entire history of his life to an audience who knew it already. With him and the guards, the other questioners, the men in white coats, O'Brien, Julia, Mr. Sharrington, all rolling down the corridor together and shouting with laughter. some dreadful thing which had lain embedded in the future had somehow been skipped over and not happened. Everything was all right. There was no more pain. The last detail of his life was laid bare, understood, forgiven. He was standing up the plank bed in half certainty when he heard O'Brien's voice. Although he had never seen him, he had had the feeling that O'Brien was at his elbow, just out of sight. It was O'Brien who was directing everything. It was he who set the guards on Winston and who prevented them from killing him. It was he who decided that Winston should scream with pain, when he should have a respite, when he should be fed, when he should sleep, when the drug should be pumped into his arm. It was he who asked the questions and suggested the answers. He was the tormentor. He was the protector. He was the inquisitor. He was the friend. And once Winston could not sleep, whether it was in drug sleep or normal sleep, even in moments of wakefulness, a voice murmured in his ear, "Don't worry, Winston. You are in my keeping. For 7 years I've watched over you. Now the turning point has come. I shall save you. I shall make you perfect." He was not sure whether it was O'Brien's voice, but it was the same voice that had said to him, "We shall meet in a place where there is no darkness," in that other dream 7 years ago. He did not remember any ending to his interrogation. There was a period of blackness, and the cell or room in which he was now had gradually materialized around him. He was almost flat on his back, unable to move. His body was held down at every essential point. Even the back of his head was gripped in some manner. O'Brien was looking down at him gravely and rather sadly. His face seemed, from below, looked coarse and worn, his pouches under his eyes and tired lines from nose to chin. He was older than Winston had thought him. He was perhaps 48 or 50. Under his hand there was a dial with a lever on top and figures running around the face. "I told you," said O'Brien, "that if we meet again, it would be here." "Yes," said Winston. Without any warning except the slight movement of O'Brien's hand, a wave of pain flooded his body. It was a frightening pain because he could not see what was happening, and he had the feeling that some mortal injury was being done to him. He did not know whether the thing was really happening or whether the effect was electrically produced, but his body was being wrenched out of shape, the joints being slowly torn apart. Although the pain had brought sweat out of his forehead, the worst of all was the fear that his backbone was about to snap. He set his teeth, breathed hard through his nose, tried to keep the silent as long as possible. "You are afraid," said O'Brien, watching his face. "That in another moment something is going to break. Your especial fear is that it will be your backbone. You have a vivid mental picture of the vertebrae snapping apart and the spinal fluid dripping out of them. Is that what you were thinking, is it not, Winston?" All right, we're about to get to the good part here where O'Brien really messes with the guy. So we're going to take another quickie break, and we will be right back after this quickie break.
Food waste is one of the most easily solvable problems, literally the low-hanging fruit of environmentalism. Pardon the pun, it's my job.
About 20% of all produce never makes it off the farm.
It's because they just look a little funny.
A little weird, but when you cut into it, it's perfectly good food.
It's just a total shame. It's totally good stuff.
We buy ugly produce directly from farms that often would go to waste because supermarkets won't buy it because of how it looks, and we deliver it to people's doors.
Beauty standards for an apple.
This isn't that ugly at all. Like, that's the most common first box, like, complaint we get.
We change that. We educate people. We show them how amazing these fruits and vegetables are.
To have food delivered to your house.
Box of produce every week.
And it's more affordable.
At a very reasonable price.
Cheaper than the grocery store.
I spend a lot less time in grocery stores.
It's an adventure every time that you open your box.
High quality produce.
There's nothing wrong with the produce.
And they taste exactly the same, if not better.
Save those fruits and vegetables that get wasted every year.
And it's delivered to your door, like,
Why wouldn't you do?
Please go to our website, freedomizerradio.live, and sign up for Imperfect Foods today. Use our promo code and get money off your first order. Go ahead and get some organic and all-natural meats, dairy, snacks, breads, and non-GMO produce.
Peace, what's up, y'all? This is Ninja Scroll. Check out my newest album, Renewed Mind, with songs like this. Solve Coagula.
Solve Coagula. Tear down and rebuild the whole system. Bible prophecy fulfilled.
Snakes in the grass.
Son of position. We got snakes in the grass. Rally through the high pass. Traps all laid out. Avoid the bomb blast.
I gotcha.
I got ya right where I want ya. Like a wall line in the field, I stalked ya. Creeped up on ya, peeped on your aura. Laying in wait, ready to pounce on ya. Once I get ya, you'll be a goner.
Can you hear me now?
We just all part of the game.
In the scene with solo, now it's time to open up your eyes. Look at how you're living, just to follow the world with Satan.
And the new norms, the new world order. Yeah, go get yours right now at officialninjascroll.web.com. That's official, ninjascroll.web.com.
Trying to show you everything, but you ain't care. Got you running scared, it's fear that is the main weapon. Peace to the people that was always prepping. I'm stepping on toes trying to wake you up.
Alrighty, we are back with Open World, and prior to this, we were kind of going over the study that was done in Japan just recently. The results were released that AI is able to essentially create pictures that are in your head, recreate pictures that are in your head that your brain is giving off with that kind of thing. So we're reading the chapter in 1984 that is talking about, actually, this reminded me exactly of that. So far, Winston has been brought into the Ministry of Love. He has been tortured. Now he is about to have his mental torture taken to the next level. Okay. So I'm going to, here we go. Winston did not answer. O'Brien drew back the lever on the dial. The wave of pain receded almost as quickly as it had come. That was 40, said O'Brien. You can see the numbers on this dial run up to 100. Will you please remember, throughout our conversation, that I have it in my power to inflict pain on you at any moment and to whatever degree I choose? If you tell me any lies or attempt to prevaricate in any way or even fall below your usual level of intelligence, you will cry out in pain instantly. Do you understand that? Yes, said Winston. O'Brien's manner became less severe. He resettled his spectacles thoughtfully and took a pace or two up and down. When he spoke, his voice was gentle and patient. He had the air of a doctor, a teacher, and even a priest, anxious to explain and persuade rather than to punish. I am taking trouble with you, Winston, he said, because you are worth trouble. You know perfectly well that what is the matter with you. You have known it for years, though you have fought against the knowledge. You are mentally deranged. You suffer from a defective memory. You are unable to remember real events, and you persuade yourself that you remember other events which never happened. Fortunately, it is curable, and you have never cured yourself of it, because you did not choose to. There was a small effort of the will that you were not ready to make. Even now, I am well aware, you are clinging to your disease under the impression that it is a virtue. Now we will take an example. At this moment, which power is Oceania at war with? When I was arrested, Oceania was at war with East Asia. With East Asia, good. And Oceania has always been at war with East Asia, has it not? Winston drew in his breath. He opened his mouth to speak, and then did not speak. He could not take his eyes away from the dial. The truth, please, Winston. Your truth. Please tell me what you think you remember. I remember that until a week before I was arrested, we were not at war with East Asia at all. We were in an alliance with them. The war was against Eurasia, and that had lasted 4 years. Before that, Brian stopped him with a movement of the hand. Another example, he said. Some years ago, you had a very serious delusion indeed. You believed that three one-time party members named Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford, men who were executed for treachery and sabotage after making the fullest possible confession, were not guilty of the crimes they were charged with. You believed that you had seen unmistakable documentary evidence proving that their confessions were false. There was a certain photograph about which you had a hallucination. You believed you had actually held it in your hands. It was a photograph something like this. An oblong slip of newspaper had appeared between O'Brien's fingers. For perhaps 5 seconds, it was within the angle of Winston's vision. It was a photograph, and there was no question of its identity. It was the photograph. There was another copy of the photograph of Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford at the party function in New York, which he had chanced upon 11 years ago and promptly destroyed. For only an instant, it was before his eyes. Then it was out of sight again, but he had seen it. Unquestionably, he had seen it. He made a desperate, agonizing effort to wrench the top half of his body free. It was impossible to move so much as a centimeter in any direction. For the moment, he even forgot the dial. All he wanted was to hold the photograph in his fingers again, or at least want to see it again. "He exists," he cried. "No," said Brian. He stepped across the room. There was a memory hole in the opposite wall. O'Brien lifted the grating. Unseen, the frail slip of paper was whirling away on the current of warm air. It was vanishing into a flash of flame. O'Brien turned away from the wall. "Ashes," he said. "Not even identifiable ashes. Dust. It does not exist. It never did." "But it did exist. It does exist. It exists in memory. I remember. You remember it." "I do not remember it," said O'Brien. Winston's heart sank. That was doublethink. He had a feeling of deadly helplessness. If he could have been certain that O'Brien was lying, it would have not seemed to matter. But it was perfectly possible that O'Brien had really forgotten the photograph, and so then already he would have forgotten his denial of remembering it, and forgotten the act of forgetting. How could one be sure it was simple trickery? Perhaps the lunatic dislocation in his mind could really have happened. That was a thought that defeated him. O'Brien was looking down at him speculatively. More than ever, he had the air of a teacher taking pains in a wayward but promising child. "There is a party slogan dealing with the control of the past," he said. "Repeat it if you please." "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past," repeated Winston obediently. "Who controls the present controls the past," said O'Brien, nodding his head with slow approval. "Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence?" Again, the feeling of helplessness descended upon Winston. His eyes slitted towards the dial. He not only did not know whether yes or no was the answer that would save him from pain, he did not even know which answer he believed the one to be true. O'Brien smiled faintly. "You are no metaphysician, Winston," he said. "Until this moment, you had never considered what is meant by existence. I will put it more precisely. Does the past exist concretely in space? Is there a somewhere or another a place, a world of solid objects, where the past is still happening?" "No." "Then where does the past exist, if at all?" "In records. It is written down." "In records and in the mind, in human memories." "In memory. Very well, then. We, the party, control all records. We control all memories. Then we control the past, do we not?" "But how can you stop people from remembering things?" cried Winston again, momentarily forgetting the dial. "It is involuntary. It is outside oneself. How can you control memory? You have not controlled mine." O'Brien's manner grew severe again. He laid his hand on the dial. "On the contrary," he said, "you have not controlled it. That is what brought you here. You are here because you failed in humanity and self-discipline. You would not make the act of submission, which is the price of sanity. You preferred to be a lunatic, a minority of one. Only the disciplined mind can see reality, Winston. You believe that reality is something eternal, existing in its own right. You also believe that the nature of reality is self-evident. When you delude yourself into thinking that you see something, you assume that everyone else sees the same as you. But I tell you, Winston, the reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else, not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes and in any case soon perishes, only in the mind of the party, which is collective and moral. Whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. It is impossible to see the reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact you have got to relearn, Winston. It needs an act of self-destruction, an effort of the will. You must humble yourself before you can become sane." He paused for a few moments as though to allow what he had been saying to sink in. "Do you remember," he went on, "writing in your diary, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4? "Yes," said Winston. O'Brien held up his hand. It's back toward Winston, the thumb hidden from the four fingers. "How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?" "4. And if the party says that it is not four but five, then how many? Four. The word ended in a gasp of pain. The needle of the dial had shot up to 55. The sweat had sprung out over Winston's body. The air tore into his lungs and issued again in deep groans, which even the clenching his teeth could not stop. O'Brien watched him. The four fingers extended. He drew back the lever. This time the pain was only slightly eased. How many fingers, Winston? Four. The needle went up to fingers. 60. How many fingers, Winston? Four. Four. What else can I say? Four. The needle must have risen again, but he did not look at it. The heavy, stern face and four fingers filled his vision. The fingers stood up before his eyes like pillars, enormous, blurry, and seeming to vibrate, but unmistakable before. How many fingers, Winston? Four. Stop it. Stop it. How can you go on? Four. Four. How many fingers, Winston? Five. 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 No. That is of no use. You are lying. You still think there are four. How many fingers, please? Four. Five. Four. Anything you like. Only stop it. Stop the pain. Abruptly, he was sitting up with O'Brien's arm around his shoulders. He had perhaps lost consciousness for a few seconds. The bonds that had held his body down were loosened. He felt very cold. He was shaking uncontrollably. His teeth were chattering. The tears were rolling down his cheeks. For a moment, he clung to O'Brien like a baby, curiously comforted by the heavy arm around his shoulders. He had the feeling that O'Brien was his protector, and the pain was something that came from the outside, from some other source, and that it was O'Brien who would save him from it. "You are a slow learner, Winston," said O'Brien gently. "How can I help it?" he blubbered. "How can I help seeing what is in front of my eyes? Two and two are four. Sometimes, Winston, sometimes there are five. Sometimes there are three. Sometimes they are all of them at once. You must try harder. It is not easy to become sane." He laid Winston down on the bed. The grip of his limbs tightened again. But the pain had ebbed away from the trembling. It stopped, leaving him merely weak and cold. O'Brien motioned his head to the man in the white coat, who had stood immobile throughout the proceedings. The man in the white coat bent down, looked closely into Winston's eyes, felt his pulse, laid his ear on his chest, tapped here and there, and then nodded to O'Brien. "Again," said O'Brien. The pain flowed through Winston's body. The needle must have been at 70, 75. He shut his eyes this time, and he knew that the fingers were still there, and still four. All that mattered was somehow to stay alive until the spasms was over. He had ceased to notice whether he was crying out or not. The pain lessened again. He opened his eyes. O'Brien had drawn back the lever. "How many Winston's fingers, Winston?" "Four. I suppose there are four. I would see five if I could, but I am trying to see five." "Which do you wish to persuade me that you see five, or really to see them?" "Really to see them." "Again," said O'Brien. Perhaps the needle was 80, 90. Winston could not intermittently remember why the pain was happening. Behind his screwed-up eyelids, a forest of fingers seemed to be moving in a sort of dance, weaving in and out, disappearing behind one another and reappearing again. He was trying to count them. He could not remember why. He knew only that it was impossible to count them, and that this was somehow due to a mysterious identity between five and four. The pain died down again, and he had opened his eyes to find that he was still seeing the same thing. Innumerable fingers, like moving trees, were streaming past in either direction, crossing and recrossing. He shut his eyes again. "How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?" "I don't know. I don't know. You will kill me if you do that again. Four, six, in all honesty, I don't know." "Better," said O'Brien. A needle slid into Winston's arm. Almost in the same instant, a blissful healing warmth spread throughout his body. The pain was already half forgotten. He opened his eyes and looked up gratefully at O'Brien, a sight of heavy, lined face so ugly and so intelligent, his heart seemed to turn over. If he could have moved, he would have stretched out his hand and laid it on O'Brien's arm. He had never loved him so deeply at this moment. And not merely because he had stopped the pain, the old feeling that at bottom, it did not matter whether O'Brien was a friend or an enemy. He had come back. O'Brien was a person who could be talked to. Perhaps one did not want to be loved so much to be understood. O'Brien had tortured him to the edge of lunacy, and in a little while, it was certain he would send him to his death. It made no difference. In some sense, further than friendship, they were inmates. Somewhere or other, although the actual words might never have been spoken, There was a place that they could meet and talk. O'Brien was looking down at him with an expression which suggested that the same thought might be in his mind. When he spoke, it was an easy conversational tone. "Do you know where you are, Winston?" he said. "I don't know. I can guess. In the Ministry of Love." "Do you know how long you've been here?" "I don't know. Days, weeks, months. I think it's been months." "Why do you imagine that we bring people to this place? To make them confess?" "No, that is not the reason. Try again." "To punish them." "No," explained Brian. His voice changed extraordinarily, and his face had suddenly become both stern and animated. "No, not merely to extract your confession, not to punish you. Shall I tell you why we have brought you here?" "To cure you, to make you sane. Will you understand, Winston, that no one whom we bring to this place ever leaves our hands uncured? We are not interested in those stupid crimes that you have committed. The party is not interested in the overt act. The thought is that we care is all we care about. We do not merely destroy our enemies, we change them. Do you understand what I mean by that?" He was bending over Winston. His face looked enormous because of its nearness, and hideously ugly because it was seen from below. Moreover, it was filled with a sort of exaltation, a lunatic intensity. Again, Winston's heart shrank. If it had been possible, he would have cowered deeper into the bed. He felt certain that O'Brien was about to twist the dial out of sheer wantonness. At this moment, however, O'Brien turned away. He took a pace or two up and down. Then he continued less vehemently. "The first thing for you to understand is that in this place there are no martyrdoms. You have read the religious persecutions of the past. The Middle Ages, there was an Inquisition. It was a failure. It set out to eradicate heresy and ended up perpetuating it, and ended by perpetuating it. For every heretic it burned at the stake, thousands of others rose. Why was that? Because the Inquisition killed its enemies in the open and killed them while they were still unrepentant. In fact, it killed them because they were unrepentant. Men were dying because they would not abandon their true beliefs. Naturally, all the glory belonged to the victim and all the shame to the Inquisitor who burned him. Later in the 20th century, there were totalitarians, as they were called. There were German Nazis and Russian communists. The Russians persecuted heresy more cruelly than the Inquisition had done, and they imagined that they had learned from the mistakes from the past. They knew, at any rate, that one must not make martyrs. Before they exposed their victims to public trial, they deliberately set themselves to destroy their dignity. They wore them down by torture and solitude until they were despicable, cringing wretches, confessing whatever they put in their mouths, covering themselves with abuse, accusing and sheltering behind one another, whimpering for mercy. And yet, after only a few years, the same thing had happened over and over again. The dead men had become martyrs, and their degradation was forgotten. Once again, why was it? In the first place, because the confessions that they had made were obviously extorted and untrue. We do not make mistakes of that kind. All the confessions that are uttered here are true. We make them true, and above all, we do not allow the dead to rise up against us. You must stop imagining that posterity will vindicate you, Winston. Posterity will never hear of you. You will be lifted clean from the stream of history. We shall turn you into gas and pour you into the stratosphere. Nothing will remain of you, not a name in a register, not a memory in a living brain. You will be annihilated in the past as well as in the future. You will have never existed. Then why bother to torture me, thought Winston, with a momentary bitterness. O'Brien checked his step as though Winston had uttered the thought out loud. His large, ugly face came nearer and his eyes a little narrowed. "You are thinking," he said, "that since we intend to destroy you utterly, so that nothing you say or do can make the smallest difference, in that case, why do we go through the trouble of interrogating you first?" "That is what you were thinking, was it not?" "Yes," said Winston. O'Brien smiled slightly. "You are a flaw in the pattern, Winston. You are a stain that must be wiped out. Did I not tell you just now that we are different from the persecutors of the past? We are not content with negative obedience, nor even with the most abject submissions. When finally you surrender to us, it must be your own free will. We will not destroy the heretic because he resists us. As long as he resists us, we will never destroy him. We convert him, we capture his inner mind, we reshape him. We burn all evil and all illusion out of him. We bring him over to our side, not in appearance, but genuinely heart and soul. We make him one of ourselves before we kill him. It is intolerable to us that an erroneous thought should exist anywhere in the world, however secret and powerless it may be. Even in the instant of death, we cannot permit any deviation. In the old days, the heretic walked to the stake, still a heretic, proclaiming his hearsay, exulting in it. Even the victim of the Russian purges would carry rebellion locked up in his skull as he walked down the passage waiting for the bullet. But we make the brain perfect before we blow it out. The command of the old despotisms was thou shalt not, and the command of the totalitarians was shalt thou shalt. Our command is thou art. And one whom we bring into this place ever stands out against us. Everyone is washed clean. Even those three miserable traitors in whose innocence you once believed, Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford. In the end, we broke them down. I took part in their interrogation myself. I saw them gradually worn down, whimpering, groveling, weeping, and in the end, it was not with pain or fear, only in penitence. But the time we had finished with them, they were only shells of men. There was nothing left in them except for sorrow for what they had done and love of Big Brother. It was touching to see how they loved him. They begged to be shot quickly so that they could die with their minds still clean. His voice had grown almost dreamy. The exaltation, the lunatic enthusiasm was still in his face. He was not pretending, thought Winston. He is not a hypocrite. He believes every word he says. What most oppressed him was the consciousness of his own intellectual inferiority. He watched the heavy yet graceful form strolling to and fro and out of the range of his vision. O'Brien was being in all ways larger than himself. There was no idea that he ever had or could have that O'Brien had not long ago examined him and rejected. His mind contained Winston's mind. But in that case, how could it be true that O'Brien was mad? It must be he, Winston, who was mad. O'Brien halted and looked down at him. His voice had grown stern again. Do not imagine that you will save yourself, Winston, however completely you surrender to us. No one who has gone once astray is ever spared. And even if we choose to let you live out the natural term of your life, still you would never escape from us. What happens to you here is forever. Understand that in advance. We shall crush you down to the point from which there is no coming back. Things will happen to you from which you will never recover. If you lived 1,000 years, never again will you be capable of ordinary human feeling. Everything will be dead inside of you. Never again will you be capable of love or friendship or joy of living or laughter or curiosity or courage or integrity. You will be hollow. We shall squeeze you empty, and then we shall fill you with ourselves. He paused and signed to the man in the white coat. Winston was aware of some heavy piece of apparatus being pushed into place behind his head. O'Brien had sat down beside the bed so that his face was almost on a level of Winston's. 3,000, he said, speaking over Winston's head to the man in the white coat. Two soft pads, which felt slightly moist, clamped themselves against Winston's temples. He quailed. There was pain coming, a new kind of pain. O'Brien laid a hand reassuringly, almost kindly, on his. This time it will not hurt, he said. Keep your eyes fixed on mine. At this moment there was a devastating explosion, or what seemed to be like an explosion, that it was not certain whether there was any noise. It was undoubtedly a blinding flash of light. Winston was not hurt, only prostrated. Although he had already been lying on his back when the thing happened, he had a curious feeling that he had been knocked into position. Painless blow had flattened him out, and something had happened inside of his head. As his eyes regained their focus, he remembered who he was and where he was and recognized the face that was gazing into his own. But somewhere or other, there was a large patch of emptiness, as though a piece had been taken out of his brain. It will not last, said O'Brien. Look me in the eyes. What country is Oceania at war with? Winston thought. He knew what he meant by Oceania and that he himself was a citizen of Oceania. He had also remembered Eurasia and East Asia, but who was at war with whom he did not know. In fact, he had not been aware that there was any war. I don't remember. Oceania is at war with East Asia. Do you remember that now? Yes. Oceania has always been at war with East Asia. Since the beginning of your life, since the beginning of the party, since the beginning of history, the war had continued without a break. Always the same war. Do you remember that? Yes. 11 years ago, you created a legend about three men who had been condemned to death for treachery. You pretended that you had seen a piece of paper which proved them innocent. No such piece of paper ever existed. You invented it, and later you grew to believe it. You remember now the very moment at which you first invented that paper. Invented it. Do you remember that? Yes. Just now I held up the fingers of my hand to you. You saw my fingers. Do you remember that? Yes. O'Brien held up the fingers of his left hand with the thumb concealed. There are five fingers there. Do you see five fingers? Yes. He did see them for a fleeting instant before the scenery changed. He saw five fingers and there was no deformity. Then everything was normal again, and the old fear and hatred, the bewilderment came crowding back again. And there had been, for a moment, he did not know for how long, 30 seconds perhaps, a luminous certainty, when each new suggestion of O'Brien had filled up the patch of emptiness to become absolute truth, when two and two could have been easily as three and five, if that were that what was needed. It had faded before O'Brien had dropped his hand, but though he could not recapture it, he could remember it, as one remembers a vivid experience at some point, period of one's life, when one was in effect a different person. You see now, said O'Brien, that it is at any rate possible. Yes, said Winston. O'Brien stood up with satisfied air. Over his left, Winston saw the man in the white coat break an ampoule and draw back the plunger of a syringe. O'Brien turned to Winston with a smile. In almost the old manner, he resettled the spectacles to his nose. Do you remember writing in your diary, he said, that it did not matter whether I was a friend or enemy, since I was a person who understood you and could be talked to? You are right. I enjoy talking to you. Your mind appeals to me. It resembles my own mind, except that you happen to be insane. Before we bring the session to an end, you can ask me a few questions if you choose. Any question I like, anything. He saw Winston's eyes were upon the dial. It is switched off. What is your first question? What have you done with Julia? Said Winston. O'Brien smiled again. She betrayed you, Winston, immediately, unreservedly. I had seldom seen anyone come over to us so promptly. You would hardly recognize her if you saw her. All her rebelliousness, her deceit, her folly, her dirty-mindedness, everything has been burned out of her. It was a perfect conversation, a textbook case. You tortured her? O'Brien left this unanswered. Next question, he said. Does Big Brother exist? Of course he exists. The party exists. Big Brother is the embodiment of the party. Does he exist in the same way I exist? You do not exist, said O'Brien. Once again, the sense of helplessness assailed him. He knew, or he could imagine, that the argument which proved in his own non-existence. But they were nonsense. They were only a play on words. Did not the statement, you do not exist, contain a logical absurdity? But what was it to say so? His mind shriveled as he thought of the unanswerable mad arguments in which O'Brien would demolish him. I think I exist, he said wearily. I'm conscious of my own identity. I was born and I shall die. I have arms and legs. I occupy a particular point in space. No other object can apply the same point simultaneously. In that sense, does Big Brother exist? It is of no importance he exists. Will Big Brother ever die? Of course not. How could he ever die? Next question. Does the Brotherhood exist? That, Winston, you will never know. If we choose to set you free when we have finished with you, and if you live to be 90 years old, you will never learn anything whether the answer to that question is yes or no. As long as you live it will be unresolved little in your mind. Winston lay silent. His breath rose and fell a little faster. He still had not asked the question that had come to his mind first. He had got to ask it, and yet it was as though his tongue would not utter it. There was a trace of amusement in O'Brien's face. Even his spectacles seemed to wear an ironical gleam. Who knows? Thought Winston suddenly. He knows what I am going to do, going to ask. Sorry. He knows, thought Winston suddenly. He knows what I am going to ask. At the thought of the words burst out of him. What is room 101? The expression on O'Brien's face did not change. He answered dryly. You know what is in room 101, Winston. Everyone knows what is room 101. He raised a finger to the man in the white coat. Evidently, the session was at an end. The needle jerked into Winston's arm. He sank almost instantly into a deep sleep. So that's where I'm going to end there. And you can go to YouTube and type in, 1984 Orwell, and you can listen to it on YouTube, or you can head over and buy the book, or there's many, many sources where you can get the book for free, libgen.is being one of them. But yeah, this is what made me think about this, going over this tonight, that I was just like, whoa, wait a minute. This is kind of freaky. This is kind of scary. This is kind of like, you know, it's almost like they predicted it, but at the same time, these are the kind of things that these experiments were starting to aim for. And now that AI is becoming more available and is actually able to read people's minds, when they're saying that, you know, we could study science and all those kind of things, this is automatically where my mind comes to. This right here is automatically where my mind comes to, that, you know, oh, we could use this to benefit science. Yeah, but at what point is it science and what point is it mind control? You know what I mean? It's like, at what point are they going to be using this on people who are against the government, who want to have freedom, who understand things like the natural laws and stuff, who want to go against the mind control that they're trying to bring in through the television, kind of thing. I don't know if that'll be happening anytime soon. All I do know is that it is very real and very possibly on the table, and it's coming a lot sooner than we'd like to think that it's coming. And it's going to be a very scary situation when it does, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. It's a matter of when. The people at the top, they've been working at this for a while, and they already know this is happening. This is why they're exempting themselves from things like the 15-minute cities. This is why they're exempting themselves from the vaccines and all these other things. This is why they're exempting themselves from absolutely everything and building, you know, this is why they're working on owning everything. Well, we own absolutely nothing. They will own it all. They will own it all. So I'm going to head out for tonight. I will catch you guys again next week, Friday. We'll try and get a guest on to chitty chat with, but we will catch you guys again this next Friday, and I hope you have a very good Friday, and thanks for showing up with me. And talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.